Okay, so it wasn't like the internet. So now we can continue on the next phase of the gradual training here. So this morning we had a look at right view, no sorry, not right view, right action and right speech. And now we're going to move on to right livelihood, or the equivalent of right livelihood on the gradual training here. And just before I do that, I just want to maybe emphasize again that this idea of morality and ethics on the Buddhist path, which I think is one of the very beautiful things about Buddhism, is this kind of very flexible framework of ethics, which is very different from the vast majority of ethics you find around in the world. It's very kind of unique to the Buddhist teachings, and has based on very natural foundations, and then built upon that, based upon the idea that motivation is what really matters in Buddhist ethics. I did promise to summarize. That's my summary from this morning that you have a little bit late, but there you are. So now we can move on to right livelihood. And this is a little bit different. There's two types of right livelihood. There's right livelihood for monastics is one thing, and right livelihood for lay people is slightly different from that. For monastics, basically, we're going to see that in a second what it means. Right livelihood is just your robe and bowls. Yeah, you have your bowl with you, walk around, people give you some food, and then that's kind of your livelihood. For lay people, it's not actually mentioned in this particular sutta, but for lay people, the idea of right livelihood is to live in such a way that you live a harmless life towards other beings. Yeah, so it is specifically mentioned in the sutta that not to trade in weapons, or trade in meat, or trade in poisons, and that kind of stuff. In other words, things that are used to harm other people. That's essentially what it is for lay people. But this little passage is quite interesting because there's more to it than meets the eye straight away. And we're going to try to draw out maybe a little bit of the meaning of this passage. So this is how it goes. He becomes content, or he is content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it flies, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the bhikkhu becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out taking only these with him. Yeah, so that is the short little paragraph on the idea of contentment. It's actually a passage on contentment on the Buddhist path. And it's interesting how this actually relates to right livelihood, right? The passage is really about contentment, but it is also about right livelihood at the same time. And I like this passage. It's so simple and so kind of, just like a bird which only has its wings, nothing else when you travel around. The ideal monastic, this is very rare these days, unfortunately, but the ideal monastic, all you have is your robes and your bowl. Yeah, it's becoming very difficult to live like that in the modern societies, but still, even today, occasionally you find monastics live almost in this way. It's very, very simple, and imagine the simplicity. You move around in the world, you just take your bag, and you may have your bowl in your bag, and you walk off, and that's it. And you have all your belongings with you. Never have to go back anywhere. There's no kind of connections or attachments. All my books, right? That's what I think when I go. All my books. My cutie. Oh, what's going to happen to my books? And so none of that kind of business. And you just walk on and you leave things behind. And there's something very freeing about that. Yeah? A very, very non-detached kind of existence that you have when you live like that. And some of the monastics who I know who lived almost like this, there's a very famous a German monk called Venerable Nyana Vimala, right? We have Venerable Vimala Nyani over here. It's almost exactly the same. Did you choose that name because of Venerable Nyana Vimala? Coincidence, really. Okay. I thought it might be the German connection or something. Yeah. Okay, coincidence, that's interesting. Yeah. And he's a very famous monk who lived in Sri Lanka, and he died now a few years ago. I can't remember exactly how many years. And he started out his monastic career in Sri Lanka, and in the beginning he studied in a place called the Island Hermitage, which was started by another German monk called Venerable Nyanatiloka. He started this Island Hermitage, And this Iron Hermit has a lot of famous monks going through there, some German, some British, various nationalities. And he was there on the Iron Hermitage for 10 years, learning the suttas, reading the suttas. Yeah, that was the main thing he did, meditation and sutta reading, sutta study. And then after 10 years, he set out wandering here. And for the next, I don't know, 40 years or whatever, 35 years, he wandered around Sri Lanka, almost never staying in one place more than one night. Depending on the situation during the rainy period, he would stay for 3 months. He might find a place which was suitable for meditation, stay a few days. But otherwise, he would wander around, yeah, and just wander from place to place. And the only way you can do that, you can live a kind of wandering existence, is if you have few possessions. You can't have a library with you, right? It makes it very inconvenient. But if you have just ball and robe, it's very easy, because that's all you carry with you. And as far as the suttas is concerned, you might think, well, how did he read the suttas if he didn't have any books? And this was before the time of the tablets and that kind of stuff. And of course, he had memorized all the suttas. So he was almost like one of these ancient monks or nuns taken out of the time of the Buddha, who had memorized the suttas. Yeah, the suttas were in his head. And whenever he wanted to kind of reflect on the Dhamma or whatever, he would just bring up the sutta in his mind and then actually recall it and reflect on it in that way, just like they did 2,500 years ago. Very inspiring. And of course, what is, of course, even more inspiring is that he was regarded by many to be an Aryan, right? Many people said he was an Aryan. Some people said he was even an Arahant. Ajahn Brahm went to Sri Lanka in 1992 or something like that. And when he went there, he met Ramana Vimala. He met him in Colombo. By this stage, he was getting old and he was staying in one place. So Ajahn Brahm went there, and Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi was staying there at the same time. So Venerable Bhikkhu was like, oh, come, I'll invite you, I'll introduce you to this really, really impressive monk, right? And I said, okay, sure, let's go and have a look. And so they went down and they kind of paid their respect for this very famous monk. And then afterwards, he gave a discourse, he gave a talk, Dhamma talk, to Ajahn Brahm and whoever else was present. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi left because he had some business or whatever in it. And he really regretted it afterwards, apparently. Yeah. But so Ajahn Brahm was there, and Ajahn Brahm said the Dhamma talk he got from this Venerable Ananda Vimala was the best Dhamma talk he had ever heard in his entire life. Yeah, and Ajahn Brahm, he had been around, he had kind of was in Thailand with some of the best monks in Thailand, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Tate, many of these people. And yet, when he went to Sri Lanka and met this German monk, that was the best Dhamma talk he ever heard. Yeah. And perhaps that is a cultural thing, right? When you're both from the West, you kind of, there is also something that's a bit more, perhaps, a meeting of minds because of that. Possibly it might be one thing here. But anyway, it says something about how special this monk was. Yeah, because Ajahn Brahm has met many very special monks in his life. So that is Venerable Vimala. He lived like this bird, right? He had his two wings, ball on one side, robes on the other side. That's all he had. And he wandered around Sri Lanka in this one here. And recently when Ajahn Sudrato, who was here last year, left, or 2 years ago, whatever it is, he left Bodhinana Monastery to go to Taiwan. When he left the monastery, he had one shoulder bag. That was it. All his possessions in one shoulder bag. Yeah, also quite inspiring. I think there was a small laptop in that shoulder bag. That's what you have to, you know, you can barely survive without that either, especially if you are on Sudato. So that's kind of what happens. That's part of the course, as they say here. So anyway, so this is the ideal, and it's a very nice ideal. And part of the idea behind this, which is why this passage is called the passage on contentment, is the idea that you are satisfied with that. Yeah, you don't actually look for anything more than a ball and robe and for the simple possessions that you have. And this is a very beautiful state of mind, because when you're satisfied with that, it means you have very few desires, you have few attachments. You don't actually think about anything else. So we are moving here from the virtue of body and speech, and we're moving on to the virtue of the mind. Contentment moving into the area of mental purity at this particular point. This is what contentment is, that taking us across from ordinary virtue onto the mental purity part of things. Because when you're content, that's it. Nothing more in the world that you need. You're just happy with the way things are. And actually, monastic life in many ways is really made for people to be content, because you can't really ask for anything here. There are all kinds of rules in the monastic discipline, monastic vinaya. You're not allowed to ask for special food. You're not allowed to ask for robes. You're not really allowed to ask for anything unless you are sick. If you're sick, you can ask for things. Otherwise, you can't ask for anything. And what that means, after a while, okay, you just shrug your shoulders. Okay, whatever I get is good enough. Because you know you can't get what you want anyway. And so monastic life is really geared towards this idea of contentment, whereby you accept whatever comes to you. Ideally, that's the ideal. Reality, of course, always a bit more complicated. I'm not going to talk about reality because it's not very inspiring sometimes. I'll talk about ideals instead. We'll stay in the head space, not in the real space. But some monks, some monastics still live like that today, and it's actually very, very useful. And it drops down, it kind of calms down your desires and things for in the world. And of course, it's not just for monastics, it's also for lay people as well. Yeah. There is a very big difference on living your life contented with the life that you have, the job you have, the partner you have, the lifestyle you have. And another one, which is the kind of lifestyle that people often have these days, where they rush around, always looking out to make more money, to kind of build up something, more wealth, more relationships, whatever, and kind of build things up more and more, just driven by greed. Well, there's a famous saying by... There was a famous Wall Street trader who got jailed later on. He said, the one who said greed is good, right? That's what happens when you walk on Wall Street for too long. You end up with that kind, those kind of ideas. Because the whole culture is geared towards that. So you become part of the culture. You don't have much choice. You get brainwashed into that way of thinking about things. So actually living a life where you are contented with things is actually very very beautiful. Whether you are a lay person or a monastic, doesn't make that much difference. Be satisfied with what you have, and you flow through the world so much more easily, much less friction, much less competition, much less problem with other people, because you are just happy with the way things are already. What is kind of weird, what I have seen in my life, those people who are often successful in life are often those people who don't, you know, if I'm talking about kind of worldly standards of success now, even those worldly standards of success, you tend to be more successful if you're keen on kind of rising in the corporate hierarchy and this kind of stuff. Even that kind of success tends to happen, in my view, to people who are more contented. Yeah, because I think maybe because other people are not afraid of them. If somebody is very competitive, you kind of say, oh, okay, you know, you kind of get a bit, you know, wary of people like that. But if somebody is contented and happy, and it means that they often have more mental energy, it means they have more of all these other good qualities at the same time, it actually tends to be, you know, to actually promote your career success. And if you don't get career success, it doesn't matter because you're content anyway. What you call a win-win situation. Yeah. So it's kind of weird. The things that promote success in the world are often very different from the things that we think promote success. What is Ajahn Brahm saying? Success doesn't give you happiness. It's happiness that gives you success. Yeah, and it's exactly the same thing. Contentment is happiness. So this is how it can really move in the right direction. Yeah. So anyway, that is this beautiful little passage about contentment. So you are free like the bird, soaring, going wherever you like. Yeah. And now, as I said, we're moving into the space of mental purifying the mind. And what we're coming to now is going to be more on the idea of purifying the mind. This is what actually is coming up now quite strongly after this. So before that, what it says here at the very end of this passage, it says, possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. So aggregate of noble virtue, in plain English, that means possessing all these factors of virtue, all these qualities of virtue. This is called Buddhist hybrid English that we have here. And it's barely, so it's kind of a... So all these factors of virtue coming together, then you experience the bliss of blamelessness, is how I... So it's the same kind of translation, basically, the bliss of blamelessness. Why? Because you don't do anything wrong here. You don't do anything wrong, you don't kind of... you don't blame yourself. Oh, I did something bad. In fact, you do good things. And then you're happy because of that. So you experience the bliss of blamelessness. And this is one of those things that you see on the Buddhist path. You see it here and you see it everywhere. we saw it before as well, that with every stage you go on this path, you experience a certain type of bliss and happiness as a consequence. Yeah, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. This is like good in the beginning here. Although this is pretty demanding, actually, but this is what the result that comes from practicing these things in the right way here. So all the way through the path, yeah, moving from one type of bliss to another one, each one better than the previous one. Sounds good, right? Yeah, in a kind of bliss where there's no conflict, there's no problems, it's not a kind of competitive bliss where you have to beat everybody else and they feel bad because you have beaten them, or vice versa, even worse. Yeah, but it's kind of bliss that is blameless, it's kind of an internal thing that is independent of everything in the world. There's no conflict there, there's no problems with it. It's a pure kind of bliss that is blameless for all of these various reasons. Anyway, let us now move on to the passage on sense restraint. And this is, I'm going to spend quite a lot of time on this and all the implications of what this is about. This is a very important part of the Buddhist path. Of course, everything I've said so far also is very important, all the virtue and all of that, but this is where kind of a lot of the mental attitude comes into here. And this is, of course, a more kind of interesting and for many people more difficult part of the Buddhist path. So I will read this out and I'll explain to you what is going on, and then we'll make a detour into a number of other suttas before we continue on the gradual training here. So this is what it says, and I should say before I say anything else that now we're moving on to the right effort on the Buddhist path. Yeah? So right effort really starts here, and this is now all about how to build up the wholesome qualities in the mind. Maintain those wholesome qualities and then reduce the bad qualities and keep them in check, keep them down. This is what this is really all about. So this is what the Buddha has to say here. On seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and greed might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty here. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty here. So I don't know what you think, but I remember the first time I read this, I thought, what on earth is this? This is really weird. Right? All this kind of strange thing is going on here. He doesn't grasp the signs of any kind of evil, unwholesome states of covet. This needs quite a bit of explanation to really understand what is going on here. And so I will. It's actually quite simple once you see what's going on. But I'll go through it in detail. So seeing a form with the eye just means you see something. Yeah, anything you see, whenever you open your eyes, you see stuff. So that means like stuff coming in through the eye here. And when you see something, then of course that thing that you see, it will have aspects to it. Yeah, signs here is actually the word, is actually nimitta, is actually the sign there. Features is a vyanjana, I think. Anuvyanjana, perhaps. And so, basically, any aspect of anything you see, right? If you see a person, it can be the whole object, the whole person, or it can be a sub-aspect. So anything that comes through your visual apparatus is what is meant here. And then you don't grasp it. So what does it mean to grasp things, to grasp an object that you see in this way? What is the meaning of that? And of course, it is used metaphorically. It is used for the mind. It's the mind that does the grasping in this sense. So how do you know if your mind has grasped up something or not? And the way you know that is if your object kind of sticks in your mind. Yeah. So you see somebody, and maybe you don't like them, so you kind of get this kind of negative perception sticking in your mind. The person kind of hangs around in your mind, even though they disappear from your eyesight, they hang around in your mind afterwards. That is what you meant by grasping. Or you like them, right? You think, oh, I would like to kind of sit down and have a cup of tea with them or whatever. Or you are attracted to them, whatever it is. And again, it sticks in your mind, yeah, because you are attracted to that person. So this is what grasping means, either through attraction or through aversion, either through liking or disliking, that object hangs in there. And what that means is that instead of kind of being mindful and kind of continuing and being aware of what is happening in the present moment, we tend to kind of linger in the past or linger in the future. So this is where mindfulness is lost. Yeah, ideally what we should do is move through the day without kind of these kind of attachments and aversions. And if you are able to do that all the time, consistently, it means that mindfulness is always established. And if mindfulness is always established, it means that you are able to counter these kind of tendencies when they arise. So this is the problem here. Once you grasp something, you lose your ability to regulate your mind in a way whereby it is even and whereby you avoid these defilements. So this is the grasping, and this is what we want to avoid. Why do we want to avoid this? Because if you leave your eye unguarded, then these things will invade you, it says here. And what are these things? Evil, it says here, but I think bad is a better translation. Bad, unwholesome qualities, states is a bit too permanent, perhaps. So bad, unwholesome qualities, and then we have this really terrible, this translation which is no good basically, coming up next, of covetousness and grief. So bad, unwholesome qualities of covetousness and grief. The problem sometimes with translation efforts is that if you are a translator, you try to translate one Pali word with one English word in all kinds of contexts. So the same if it's the same word, regardless of the context, you use the same kind of translation. That's what people often do. And Bhikkhu Bodhi does that, and most people do that, because it's really the only way to kind of get around translating texts. But if you want to make a change to the text, you can change things universally across the document and that kind of stuff. So it's very hard not to kind of to avoid that altogether. But what it means, because the problem with translation is that Pali words very often, or any word in any language, doesn't have a one-to-one relationship with a word in another language. Yeah, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. It's like, that's why sometimes we import words from other languages. Yeah, English is famous for importing lots of words. So if you speak English, you have a few French words, a few German words, right? In the ancient days, they even imported Norwegian words by the Vikings. Egg actually is a Viking word imported into English. Window is another one. Anyway, I'm getting carried away here. So there is no exact one-to-one relationship. And what that means is that the words that here underlie grief and covetousness, the words that underlie that have a kind of different spread in Pali than they have in the English language. And what that means is that sometimes you get really strange translation. And this is one particular instance where the translation really is kind of lost all semblance of any being meaningful in any reasonable way. So what these things actually mean, the words here are abhijja and domanasa. And what that refers to is the mental quality of being attracted to things or being averse to things. Yeah? Of desiring something or being averse to it. Of liking it and disliking it. So it is only the kind of standard reaction that we have to all the objects of the sensory world. When those objects come through the eye, they come through the ear or whatever, we tend to either like them or dislike them. Either desire them or be averse to them. Yeah? So that is really all it means. But if you look at these words, in English, grief, what is grief? Grief is the kind of thing that happens when a family member dies, right? Oh no, my mother has passed away. Oh no. That's not what you feel when you see, when you kind of see a nice sandwich, right? Or a bad sandwich. Yeah, it's kind of crazy here. So this is why it's kind of completely kind of out of any kind of semblance of reality here. Covetousness in English means that, it means like you desire somebody else's property here. Yeah, in English you have the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property or something like that. I don't know the Ten Commandments, for my life, but that's something like that is what it is in English, because I've been living in English-speaking countries for so many years. These have kind of been imbibed into me, despite my lack of interest in these things. But that's what it means, right? But here, it is not about coveting somebody's property, it's about desiring anything that arises in the sensory realm. So, this is why I always think that when we translate these texts, that the emphasis should be on getting the meaning across, rather than having some kind of system of translation where one word matches another word and then ending up having no meaning whatsoever. I think that's terrible. The idea, of course, is we need to practice these things. And the only way we're going to be able to practice these things is if we understand what's going on. I remember I showed this passage to Ajahn Brahm once, and he said to me, I think I can't remember whether it was this context or another context, but he said to me that, this is Ajahn Brahm, right? He's one of the best meditators kind of almost anywhere. He has read and studied the suttas for many, many years. And he said to me that, you know, I've been a monk for 20 years before I understood what this was about. Because it didn't make any sense in English, covetousness and grief. 20 years. And this is Ajahn Brahm. You know, who else is going to? He has a degree from Cambridge University. He's really smart. He's really intelligent. He's well practiced. He has samadhi. He has everything here, you know, on the Buddhist path. He doesn't understand this. So who is it? Nobody, right? Nobody's going to understand this. This is the problem. So we need to make translations that actually mean something here. And this is, I think, hopefully, Abhanta Siddhartha will sort that out. If he doesn't, we're allowed to tell him off. This is not good enough. Improve the translation. So this is what this means, right? So you avoid these unwholesome qualities of like and dislike, of desire and aversion to arise in you. It has this idea here of invade him, and it sounds like something coming from outside invading you, like a virus or something like that. But it's not anything about invading you from outside, it arises from within. Yeah. So again, translation could perhaps be improved upon a little bit. These things arise from within. Otherwise, we could just close our eyes and there wouldn't be any problem anymore, no defilements, but it's not quite as simple as that. So, this is the problem. This is what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to have an even mind that isn't kind of rocked about by all these things in the world. So how do we do that? And this is what this is about. And it says here, what you do is you practice the way of its restraint. In other words, you restrain the eye faculty here. Now this is very interesting because, as I mentioned before, the English word restraint usually has a sense of willpower, of force, to hold somebody back. So this would seem to mean that you hold the eye faculty back. You force it. Don't look there. Look over here. Right? That is a dangerous place. Or you think in this way. Don't think in that way. Using the will and using willpower to kind of sort it out. But this is where we often go wrong, because as I mentioned also, is that when we translate from Pali into English, we have to be very careful what we're doing, and we need to understand the broader context of the suttas to know exactly what is meant by these Pali words. So sometimes you have to be careful not to take things too literally here, and you have to know the broader context to what is going on here. But already here, it gives you some idea what restraint actually means. So what it says here is that he guards the eye faculty. Yeah. So this is the first one. And in Buddhism, the guard is always mindfulness. Mindfulness is the guard because mindfulness is the thing which is aware of what is going on. So mindfulness is like the doorkeeper or the gatekeeper standing, watching who is coming in through the senses and who is not allowed to come in. What is allowed to come in, what is not allowed to come in. Just like the guard of the city. In the old days, in ancient India, they would have cities and they would have like walls around the city, and there would be maybe one main gate, and there would be a guard at the main gate. I think it was the same thing all over the world long time ago. And then that guard would only let in the friends, right? And if there were enemies, if there were Trojan horses, that kind of stuff, Trojan horses are not allowed to come into the city here because they are bad news. So you leave those outside. So here, these objects which give rise to covetousness and greed, no, to like and dislike, desire and aversion, these are like the Trojan horses that are about to invade you and cause all kind of havoc once they are allowed inside the city here, inside the mind, which is the city here. So you guard the eye faculty, and that becomes the basis then for restraint, because when you guard it, you're able to see whether this is suitable or not, and then you can take any remedial action on that basis to stop the bad states from arising here. And that reaction that you take to stop the bad faith from arising, that is here the restraint. Yeah. So you have the awareness, and then the restraint happens on that basis. So this is then the most interesting thing. How do we actually do this restraint? How do we, and of course, one of the most classical and important things to consider here, of course, as I've mentioned before, is people. Yeah, very often you see somebody, and sometimes you just have to see somebody. You can't get along with it, and already you feel a bit negative. You get in a bit bad mood because of this person is in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yeah. So one of the main aspects of this restraint is then to learn to change your perception, to look at that person in a different way, so it doesn't give rise to these negative qualities at that time. This is one of the most important things. Secondary, by far the most important thing I would say to overcome on the Buddhist path is to overcome ill will and negativity and these kind of things of the mind. But secondary would then be to overcome the desire and the attraction. That's the secondary thing here. Because we can talk about that later on, but it's easier to deal with ill will and anger than it is to deal with desire and these kind of things. So this is roughly how this works. So this is what sensory strength is all about. So I'll just read through the rest of this paragraph. So, on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, he does not grasp at the signs, he does not grasp hold of the aspects, right, or the various qualities of an object, since if he left the mind faculty unguarded, bad, unwholesome qualities of desire and aversion might arise in him. He practices the way of its restraint, its wise restraint, using the wisdom faculty, not the willpower. And he guards the mind faculty. He undertakes the wise restraint of the mind faculty. So even the mind, right, because a lot of things just happen when we think about them, and then that is already where things kind of invade us, these negative qualities. Possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, he experiences within himself a bliss that is unsullied. Unsullied, it means it's not kind of polluted, right? It's not mixed with kind of unwholesome, with bad qualities. the idea there is that you, even if you live really well and you do all the right things, even if you feel a degree of happiness, but because the happiness is kind of polluted by negative mental states, it doesn't become pure. That's why it's kind of sullied, right? It's sullied by impure states. But then when you purify your mind of kind of strong desires and strong ill will, what happens is that the mind becomes pure and the bliss itself becomes more pure as a consequence of that. This is the second level of bliss, moving up the ladder of blisses. One bliss more powerful than the other one. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. It's kind of the idea here. So that is the idea of sensory strength. And now what I'm going to do is going to have a look at sensory strength in quite a bit of detail. So I'm going to leave the rest of the sutta for now. So just go a few pages forward until you get to the next sutta. And the next sutta is called, has the uninspiring title of AN2.12. It's better to have a name, right? It is kind of, that doesn't sound really all that impressive. But anyway, so this is this sutta. And this sutta is it just gives a very basic idea of an interesting idea, which kind of is not necessarily so obvious. So let's have a quick look at this. Because there are these two powers. What two? The power of reflection and the power of development. So, power of reflection here is patisankhana. That's reflection. Power is bala. Bala is a kind of the five powers we talked about before. It is the same kind of word that is found here. And development is bhavana. Bhavana is this word you see throughout the suttas. And very often these days, the word bhavana is used as an equivalent for meditation practice. You do bhavana, right? You sit down, you meditate. In fact, bhavana is more than that. And you really it is citta bhavana that is a word for meditation practice. And then you have sila bhavana, like development of your morality. So bhavana is also the whole path. But here it has a very specific meaning, as you will see in a second. So this is interesting, right? The power of reflection. This is already quite interesting. What on earth does that mean? And what it means is this. And what is the power of reflection? Here someone reflects thus. Bodily misconduct has a bad result in the future. And in the future, in the present life and in the future life. Verbal misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Mental misconduct has a bad result in the present life and in the future life. Having reflected thus, he abandons bodily misconduct and develops bodily good conduct. He abandons verbal misconduct and develops a verbal good conduct. He abandons mental misconduct and develops mental good conduct. He maintains himself in purity. This is called the power of reflection. Yeah, so what this means is that the way to overcome negative states, of course, body and speech kind of make sense. You reflect that they are bad and you stop doing it. But the way to overcome all negative qualities, ill will, anything else, anything which is impure, which specifically refers to ill will and sensual desires, even in the mind, right? The way to overcome that is by reflecting wisely. It doesn't say here that you overcome this by meditation practice. If you sit down and watch your breath and your mind is full of defilement, sometimes nothing happens. You don't get you anywhere here. Because the problem, there's no way that problem can disappear just by watching the breath. Right? So the way to do this, the correct way according to the Buddha, to overcome the defilements of the mind, is to reflect wisely. How we think about things. This is a critical issue. And once we think about things, we were talking about these things before, about things like yoni so manasikara, which is wise attention. Yeah? This is what wise attention comes in. So we learn the wise attention. We use that in our daily life and also in our non-daily life. Like today, like here, right? This is the non-daily life. Daily life is what you do when you go to work. Anyway, this is just my... And this may be the non-daily life because you don't do it every day here. Regardless of where you are, this is what you do to overcome the defilements of the mind. Which is very fascinating because... on the Buddhist path, there's a lot of emphasis on meditation practice usually. People go and do retreats here and there, and they try to get as many retreats as they can squeeze in every year, sit as many hours as they possibly can. But actually, the Buddha says, if you really want to overcome defilements, and this we have seen before is the foundation of all meditation practice, right? Again and again, how sila is the foundation, and then meditation happens as a consequence. Your ability to meditate will depend entirely on how you use reflection in ordinary life to overcome these defilements. The more you overcome these defilements, the more powerful your meditation will be as a consequence. And it is not meditation that overcomes these defilements, it is how you think about the world, how you think about yourself, how you reflect on all these things that is happening around us. And of course, one of the most important reflections, as I was mentioning just a second ago, is the reflection on other people. How do we think about other people? Are we able to have compassion for them when they do stupid things? Are we able to see their good qualities when they really have good qualities? If you're able to always kind of stay within the boundaries of metta, seeing the good qualities and compassion, always within those boundaries, that is when you know that you are have you only saw manasikara in regard to other people. Even the most difficult ones, yeah, even the ones that you find really hard to deal with, you think about them in this way. So this is, I think, very fascinating. I will be showing you very soon how this actually is done. And I will point out that this particular passage is also borne out other places in the suttas. It's basically the same thing. Happening in many different places. But I think this is very interesting because it's quite different from how many people often think about the Buddhist path. But here the Buddha makes it quite clear how to overcome bad conduct, even mental bad conduct, and how to develop good conduct. So now the other power, yeah? What is the power of development? here a bhikkhu develops the awakening factor of mindfulness that is based upon seclusion, distraction and cessation, maturing in release. He develops the awakening factor of discrimination of phenomena, the awakening factor of energy, the awakening factor of rapture, the awakening factor of tranquility, the awakening factor of stillness or samadhi, the awakening factor of equanimity, that is based upon seclusion, dispassion and cessation, and maturing in release. This is called the power of development. These bhikkhus are the two powers. So what is this? This is all about meditation practice. This is all about seven factors of awakening are, as I mentioned before, they are an expansion of the last two factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So they are about Samma Sati and Samma Samadhi. Samma Sati, all about meditation. Samma Samadhi, about this deep stillness that results from that meditation practice. So the power of development is about meditation. So before you get to meditation, you abandon the defilement as much as possible by reflecting wisely. And then you get the results in meditation, samadhi, and all these kind of things follow as a consequence. Of course, there isn't any absolute segregation in between these things. It's not as if meditation, of course, can be very helpful in abandoning defilement. Because when you become peaceful and you become kind of quiet, you sit by yourself, you withdraw a little bit, you get a bit more clarity and you can see more inside of yourself, you know what is happening. And that, of course, will help you in building up the power of reflection. They're not completely segregated, they're just main kind of categories of difference. And of course, the meditation such as mindfulness, or satipatthana, one of the main purposes of that is precisely to abandon the refined hindrances that remain in the mind. Yeah? So there is some overlap here. These are just kind of main distinctions that we're looking at. Okay, so anyway, so there you are. It's interesting because when I have read the suttas a lot, and one of the things that is weird when you read the suttas is that certain things stand out for you because they are things that you have never really been told. There are things that kind of you have to figure out for yourself because nobody teaches those things. And the reason why nobody teaches it is because we have all slightly different ways of applying the path and practicing these things. Yeah, so because of that, what kind of is important to you might not be important to someone else. And for that reason, it's always very nice to read the suttas on your own, because when you do that, there will be things that are very meaningful to you. And you think, wow, that is really powerful. Why didn't anyone tell me? The reason is because other people have other things that they prioritize. So this is one of those things about the Buddha, that the teachings are so broad. It kind of encompasses everybody. Everybody's defilements, yeah, are kind of encompassed by the teachings of the Buddha. So when you read them, you think, whoa, that is really nice. Well, you know, and then you know that why nobody told you, but now the Buddha has told you. And that is even better. Now I want to go into even more detail. I want to look at how this is practiced in detail, how we use the power of reflection to overcome these... I really hate these socks. I really don't want to wear them. But, that's bad, right? I hate your socks, dear. I'm not even practicing my own teaching here. Okay, so So this sutta is precisely about this, how to overcome unwholesome thoughts and how to develop wholesome thoughts. So precisely about the thing that we have been talking about now. So I will just start with the introduction to the sutta, and then tomorrow we can go into all the details about what it is about. This is called, sutta is called the Dveda Vipaka Sutta, which means two kinds of thoughts. And now we are kind of deep into the territory of right effort. Yeah, how to use right effort to overcome unwholesome states of mind. So we are on the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And we're going to be staying on that factor for quite a while there. So this is how this sutta goes at the very beginning. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove and at the Pindika's Park. There he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir," they replied, and the Blessed One said this. So here we have another one of the suttas starting with, thus have I heard. So oral tradition. And the Buddha is living at Savatthi. Savatthi is if you haven't been there, it's actually quite nice. It's kind of far away in India. Nobody really lives around this area, except for now they're starting to build up some hotels, of course, that kind of stuff. Because for all the Buddhists who come and like to be there. But it's actually quite nice. And the Jeta's Grove, Jeta was a prince in Savatthi. And he was a prince, probably maybe a descendant of King Pasenadi, or perhaps a brother of King Pasenadi. King Pasenadi lived in this was a Kosalan kingdom, and Savatthi was the capital of this Kosalan kingdom. And King Pasenadi was the king at that time, at the time of the Buddha, and he was actually a disciple of the Buddha. So Jeta would have been a prince who was some kind of family member of King Pasenadi. And the size of the Kosalan kingdom, if you see it on a map, the rough boundaries, nobody knows exactly where the boundaries were, but it would have been roughly the size of a kind of standard European country, maybe like Germany, right, or something like that. It's actually quite a large country. And this king was in charge of this whole place. And this was the capital. And this king was a disciple of the Buddha, which is quite... And there's lots of suttas, lots of conversations in the suttas between King Pasenadi and the Buddha. And they're actually quite nice. I would recommend you to read those suttas. They're quite simple, but they often have a very nice kind of Dhammic flavor to them. Where do you find those? You find them in the Sanyutta Nikaya. In the third Sanyutta called the Kosala Sanyutta. In the Sanyutta Nikaya, right here, where they are found. So, and it is also called Anathapindika's Park. This is because Anathapindika, he was this wealthy merchant at the time of the Buddha. He was living in Savatthi, and he wanted to buy a monastery for the Buddha. The Buddha had a place to stay. So he decided that this Jeta's Grove is the perfect place. So let me buy Jeta's Grove from Prince Jeta, and then I can give it to the Sangha with the Buddha at its head afterwards. And Prince Jeta does not want to sell his grove, right? He's attached to his grove, like all landowners are attached to the land. He was no exception from that. So he said, well, if you can afford it, then you can buy it, but it's going to be very, very expensive. So he says, how expensive? And he says, you have to place gold coins over the entire area of the Jeta Grove. And it's pretty large, right? It's not a small place. It's like, several hectares or whatever, several hectares large. Right? It's a large, large area. You go there now, and the crowd was even larger in those days. So then Anathapindika, being very wealthy, he covered, this is just like the legend, right? This probably didn't ever actually happen, but anyway. So it's kind of a nice story. He covered the whole place with gold coins, and Prince Jeta was amazed that he was able to afford this. And then, so this is how he gained this grove. And then afterwards, he gave it to the Sangha. And for the rest of his life, he was very poor, right? Because he spent all his money buying this Jeta's Grove and then giving it to the Sangha afterwards. This was some of these disciples did. You had so much faith, right? You kind of do anything. That was kind of what was happening here. Anyway, so this is where the Buddha stayed, and he stayed at Savatthi for many, many years, many rain retreats. During his life, it was one of his main monasteries. It was in Savatthi. If the suttas aren't spoken somewhere else, normally they're spoken at Savatthi, the vast majority of them. So this is what he says to his disciples, to the monks. Bhikkhus, before my awakening, while I was still an unawakened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. So let's stop there, because there's many things going on here that actually are quite interesting. The first thing that is interesting here is that the Buddha, he calls himself a bodhisattva, right? Before his awakening, while I was still an unawakened bodhisattva. So most of us think bodhisattva, that's Mahayana Buddhism, that's kind of a different school, because we don't have that in Theravada Buddhism, and there it is, right in front of us. Bodhisattva is like a Pali equivalent of the Sanskrit word bodhisattva. Yeah? So roughly equivalent. So what is it doing here? Does that mean that we are all Mahayana Buddhists perhaps? Is that what it means? That's one possible conclusion, but it might be the wrong one. You've got to be careful here. And so the word bodhisattva, the way it is used in the early suttas, it is almost always used exclusively for the Buddha after he went forth from the home life. Yeah? So after he decided, now I'm going to search for an end to all the suffering in the suffering in myself, death, old age, and sickness, and these kind of things. From that point on, he called himself a bodhisattva. So usually only from the point on that he actually left his home life. It is not 100% consistent because there is a sutta called the Acharya Abhuta Sutta, for example, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya, which means like the wonderful and marvelous. And this is a sutta that has all these amazing qualities that happened around the Buddha's, when the Buddha was born around that time. But that particular sutta is very, it varies a lot across the different traditions. So it seems to be a sutta which has been added to and all of these kind of things. So I must admit, I don't take that sutta all that seriously. Maybe because I'm biased as well. Of course I'm biased. We're all biased. But this is my bias. So I kind of push that sutta to one side. I think there actually are some good reasons for that. It's not just bias. I think there is some good reasons as well. But generally speaking, the idea of the bodhisattva in the early suttas is just after the Buddha left his home life and he set out in search for an end to all suffering. Yeah. So that is interesting because what that does, it kind of makes you wonder, what does this word bodhisattva actually mean? The Sanskrit version of that word bodhisattva means awakening being. A sattva is a being. Bodhi is like awakening. So awakening being is kind of strange, right? Awakening being. It kind of doesn't really gel quite. It kind of has a strange taste to it. Awakening being, there must be something more to it than that. And what is an alternative understanding of this word is actually that it is related not to bodhisattva, but to a Sanskrit word called bodhisakta. And sakta in Sanskrit means like someone who is intent on something, someone who is searching for something. Yeah, someone who is aiming for something. So it, and this was put forward by, as an idea, not, this is not my idea, this was put forward by Richard Gombrich, professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University, the one who suggested this. And it actually makes very good sense. It means the person who is searching for awakening. The one who is intent on awakening. Yeah, and I think it is a far more sensible way of looking at this word than the idea of awakening being, which kind of doesn't quite gel in my opinion. So the one who is searching for awakening, why after he went the home life? That is exactly what he was doing. He was searching for awakening, searching for an end to all the problems that he had discovered. And of course, later on, this idea of the bodhisattva, it expanded, it grew out of its very kind of simple origins, yeah? And it became a whole doctrine, became a whole path in Mahayana Buddhism, and also in Theravada itself. But it started with this very simple kind of beginnings. Yeah, I think I mentioned before, there's a book by Anālaya where he actually traces the origin of the bodhisattva ideal, how it started out in the early suttas and how it became this enormous thing later on, entire schools of Buddhism just about the bodhisattva ideal and the bodhisattva path. Very quite fascinating to trace that history and look back upon that history actually. It's available online if you want to read those books. They're all available online for free, which is really nice. And that one is definitely there. So that is just a little bit about the early Buddhist text and what bodhisattva probably means in the early Buddhist text and why it is there, so you don't kind of feel... I was really confounded. I thought, what is that doing there? That's really weird. And it took me a long time to figure it out. So then, this is the Buddha now before his awakening, right? He's still unenlightened, searching for awakening. This is kind of what the Buddha to be, I call him the Buddha to be because he's searching for awakening. This is what the Buddha to be was doing to reach his awakening. So now the Buddha to be is going to tell us how he was practicing when he started out on the path. What he did, yeah. What did I do? And why is the Buddha telling us these things? And of course the reason is to inspire us to say, this is what I did. you should be doing the same thing here. This is obviously the reason what's going on here. There are so many of these kind of suttas in the Nikaya, what I would call autobiographical suttas, where the Buddha talks about his own life and explains to us what he was doing. There are so many suttas like that, and obviously the Buddha is trying to tell us, this is what I did, you should be doing the same thing here. And this is one of the reasons why it is so important, as I mentioned before, to have a feeling for the Buddha as an ordinary human being. Yeah, he is basically like us. He had the same problems as we have before his awakening. He was kind of fighting the same Mara, right, to kind of get to the to see through, and eventually he made it through her. So when we think about the Buddha, this idea that Buddha is human, it's actually very, very important. I think this is one of the, it's maybe easier in the West because we have less cultural background. So it's relatively easy for us to regard the Buddha as human. If you grow up in a Buddhist country, it's actually very difficult because you kind of worship the Buddha as a god very often. And all of these things that you do kind of makes you feel that the Buddha is completely different. You lose sight after a while of the fact that he actually was human. So sometimes you have to kind of, okay, you know, bring things back to reality again. And the idea here is not so much that we should kind of not respect the Buddha or put the Buddha on the pedestal and see him as something astonishing, because the Buddha really is something absolutely marvelous. You know, that we have a teacher in the world, we achieve the highest kind of wisdom, as far as I'm concerned, the kind of greatest teacher that has existed in, at least in, you know, our modern history. It's astonishing that we actually have somebody still available. The teachings are here, we can follow that path. It's something to really rejoice in that we have something like that. But still, so he is worthy of tremendous respect and all of these kind of things. But it's the right kind of respect that is so important. It's the respect of humanity practiced and developed to its maximum potential, that kind of respect. Not the kind of respect you have for a god or you have for some supernatural quality, for kind of the ground of all mind or the ground of all consciousness, that kind of stuff. It's not that kind of respect. It is the respect that you have for a human being who has taken the human potential to the highest possibility. That is what it's about. And then, when you think of the Buddha like that, these teachings, these autobiographical teachings, they come alive. Because then you see the Buddha said, I did this, we should be doing the same thing. Is it what he's saying? We should practice what the Buddha said. If the Buddha is a god, if the Buddha is not like us, it's meaningless. But if the Buddha is just like us, then it becomes very meaningful. One of the interesting things that we will see as we go through the sutta is that the Buddha says, you know, I had these defilements of the mind. I had these desires. I had this ill will and these aversions. In other suttas, it talks about having wrong view. Yeah. All of these things are things that we all can relate to because we are basically in exactly the same place. So important to remember this. The Buddha to be, I should say not the Buddha, but the Buddha to be, have these problems. So then, what does he do? He divides his thoughts into two classes. Actually, I have to stop there. It's already 4 o'clock, so before us, it's kind of a little bit of a new topic. It's probably good to stop at this particular point, and then we can kind of launch into the two classes of thoughts when we meet you again tomorrow morning here. Okay, so that is all for now. So please keep on enjoying the afternoon and the evening, and we'll see you again at 7:30.